All right, our first case is In Re Sears. We've slotted 12 minutes aside on this. I understand, it seems, Mr. LeBlanc, you've got 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes.
I will just say there's a chance we may go over. That's always the presider's prerogative. Don't presume it, but if you're in the middle of something and you got a lot more to cover, you can always ask, okay?
Yes, thank you.
Great. So the floor is yours. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Andrew LeBlanc from Will Bank LLP. We represent Appellant Cyrus in this matter, and I'll be arguing the common issues on behalf of the appellants. Mr. Anker, my co-counsel, represents ESL. To the extent the Court had questions with respect to the fourth cause for reversal here, ESL issue, Mr. Anker is available to answer any questions the Court has. He also would reserve the right to use some of the 3 minutes on rebuttal to the extent that the appellees raise any issues that need addressing with respect to that particular issue. But it's my intention to argue the common issues. And I'll echo Your Honor's comments. This is my first time in an applied courtroom in 18 months, and it's great to be off of Zoom and here. As to the common issue that the Court faces, the question is, how should a bankruptcy court go about valuing a secured lender's collateral? And in this instance, for the purposes of determining how that collateral or whether that collateral diminished in value over the course of a bankruptcy case. Now, the code dictates, and this is section 506.81 of the bankruptcy code dictates, that the bankruptcy court should value that collateral, and as the Supreme Court said in Rash, with the paramount importance considering the proposed disposition or use of that collateral. That is what Justice Ginsburg found to be the critical element of the test for how to value collateral. And here, it is undisputed that what the debtor chose to do with the secured lender's collateral at the beginning of the case was to retain that collateral and to use that collateral in the course of its business.
Can I ask you a question? There's no question that Sears retained the property and then used it, but there seems to be some argument about whether there was any consent by the, let's call them the 2Ls or the second lien creditors, to them retaining and trying to dispose of that inventory because only Sears was in the position to do that. What's your statement about that?
Sure. Your Honor, there was not consent for the Sears to use our collateral without providing us what the code requires them to provide. That is adequate protection.
No, but I'm not talking about what the law requires. The question is, what was going on? Because there obviously have been sort of conflicting representations. Sears, I think, argues, and it seems to me the record bears this out in some way, that everyone, especially ESL, who was involved in trying to buy the assets, realized that Sears was the only entity in the position of trying to dispose of or sell or protect at least the value of the collateral here. So is it really accurate to say that the 2Ls didn't at least acquiesce or in some way think it was reasonable that Sears retained the property?
Your Honor, I don't think that's a reasonable conclusion. And let me be clear about what it is. At the beginning of the case, the debtor made the decision to retain the collateral. They have that right under the bankruptcy code, provided they give us adequate protection. Now, they could have negotiated for something different than that. They could have negotiated for an outcome different than providing us adequate protection. If they believed that we were better off by them retaining the collateral, they could have come to us and said, we'll settle this dispute about us retaining collateral as long as you don't get adequate protection in place.
So when the bankruptcy court said as of the petition date, everyone knew that the debtors were going to dispose of substantially all of their assets in a very short time, that the only way that secured creditors would realize any value under any realistic scenario would be to quickly dispose of them, either as a going concern in the sale or in the context of a complete liquidation. You're saying it's wrong.
Well, I'm not saying that's wrong. What I'm saying is that's both legally relevant. And
why isn't it legally relevant? The statute says what's the disposition and use going to be, and that's what the bankruptcy court said. This is the disposition or use. So it is legally relevant, right? It's different than Rash. In Rash, they were keeping the truck. Bankruptcy court concluded here that wasn't what everybody was thinking. Everybody was thinking there was going to be a race to sell the assets, essentially.
Your Honor, the part that is factually wrong about the statement you just read is the secured lenders, had the collateral been released to us, we could have easily sold that collateral. It would have taken some time. It wouldn't have yielded necessarily what Sears could have achieved in a retail sale, which is exactly what they did with our collateral, sold it in their retail stores. Well, we could have done that over time. And it would have yielded substantial value to us. In fact, the facts are undisputed that the value, the cost to Sears to acquire the collateral, just the inventory portion of our collateral, was $2.69 million. And so I think, Your Honor.
So just going back to Judge Chin's question. So this was without your client's consent. They objected to this plan. They said, we want it back.
Well, Your Honor, we settled the objection to that by at the beginning of the case, by them agreeing that they would retain, us agreeing that they would retain it, conditioned on them agreeing to provide us adequate protection under the bankruptcy code as 507B required. That means that we get exactly what Rash says we get. And Your Honor,
doesn't that distinguish it from Rash? Because Rash was a different situation where the creditors did object and it was a cram down. Here there was an objection with these protections, and then there was a process that followed. So doesn't at least factually distinguish it from Rash for purposes of the valuation, which is...
Your Honor, an argument does not factually distinguish it or legally distinguish it. It doesn't factually... We settled the dispute over whether they could retain our collateral in a cash collateral order at the first day of the case. In Rash, they objected to the use, and ultimately the court concluded, as the bankruptcy code provides, that Mr. Rash could keep his property and use it. And the lender there had to be provided with the full amount of his claim, using replacement value as the valuation standard. It's exactly the same here. We settled the objection to the use of our collateral in return for being provided with an adequate protection claim. That adequate protection claim has to be valued pursuant to Section 506, the exact same provision that was at issue in Rash. And critically, When you read Rash, I've read it, I'm sure Your Honors have too, 100 times. It's a 5-page decision.
You probably memorized it.
I'm sure we all have. We have a fundamental disagreement about how to read Rash. Rash, we think it presents what it describes as sort of a simple solution to this issue.
But you think it's a simple solution for all scenarios? I mean, the bankruptcy court's a court of equity, basically, and it contemplates, you know, enormously ranging bankruptcies from a truck to a situation like this involving billions of dollars. It would seem to me that the 506 really contemplates flexibility, not rigidity.
Your Honor, I think the court could not have been more clear that with respect to the valuation method, whether it's a replacement value or foreclosure value, it is rigid. The court says that.
Well, it can't be just sort of made up. You can't just wing it. But, I mean, certainly bankruptcy courts since Rash have been applying this contrary to the way you're proposing, right?
Well, Your Honor, I think that's a misreading of those cases as well.
Okay. Let's start with RESCAP.
So RESCAP, perfect example. RESCAP, what didn't turn on whether or not the court should use replacement value, liquidation value, or foreclosure value? That question was foreclosed by Rash. And that's what the five of Rash, where the court says, our reading of 506A makes plain, we reject a rules approach allowing use of different valuation standards based on the facts and circumstances of individual cases. What it does leave for discretion to the bankruptcy court to decide, as bankruptcy courts do all the time, is how do you value collateral? The property that's at issue. And that's where the variation in these cases comes from. RESCAP, perfect example. The issue there were certain mortgage servicing rights that the debtor had that were collateral to the lenders. The debtors presented a valuation of that, the creditors presented a valuation of that. The creditors' valuation didn't consider the fact that RESCAP itself was a distressed mortgage lender, didn't have the ability to issue loans. So who was going to pay anything for that mortgage servicing right when RESCAP itself was a distressed entity? So when it tried to determine the replacement value, or as Rash concedes in citing the Rafferty case, the fair market value, what would a willing seller pay a willing buyer, what the Supreme Court made clear, or I should say what the RESCAP court made clear, is you have to consider the nature of the debtor and the nature of the property that's at issue. That is exactly what comes out of Rash.
But isn't that exactly what we have here? I mean, going back to Judge Bianco's statement, as the bankruptcy court said, everyone knew that Sears was in a distressed state, and no one more than ESL, the ultimate buyer, because the head of ESL was the CEO of Sears Holding, right? So if anyone knew about how distressed Sears' situation was, it was the 2 hours.
But that subjective knowledge, Your Honor, I think that's exactly what footnote 5 is intended to eliminate. You're not supposed to consider those subjective facts and circumstances.
But isn't that a bit of the reality that has to get injected in terms of the market value? Because distressed means the company could go pivot towards foreclosure, I mean a liquidation, or a going concern.
And Your Honor, I think that's I think the fallacy that my friends on the other side make, and that is the nature of this collateral. This is retail inventory. Valuing that collateral is not a difficult exercise. Valuing the mortgage services rights in ResCap, difficult exercise. But the nature of this collateral to determine its replacement value, we cite the Inray Nuts and Bolts, a decision from the Pennsylvania Bankruptcy Court. That court, actually, the South Carolina Bankruptcy Court, that court makes clear that when you're dealing with retail inventory, the value of that is what it would cost the retailer to buy that inventory again, the wholesale price. And that's exactly the case here. To faithfully follow Rash, the court here should have applied the replacement value and looked at the nature of this inventory and concluded that this inventory had a replacement cost equal to what the debtor had just purchased it for. This is what the debtor is in the business of doing. Buying inventory and selling it. I see my time. I've gone over my time, Your Honor. I'll reserve the remaining.
Well,
unless the court has other questions, I'll reserve the remaining.
I
think there may be other questions. I think there's other things that you probably wanted to get to as well. And
there are.
So I don't normally let people run, you know, crashing through the red light. But I think this is a case where maybe we go over a little bit.
Sure.
Did you have something?
Yes,
particular?
I wanted to ask you about the letters of credit. We spent 8 minutes on a 5-page opinion, right? So I understand your argument regarding, you know, the deduction of the full amount seems perhaps not the most rational result here. But what the bankruptcy judge said was, he called it a difficult issue, and basically said if the choices are 0 or 9 million, and he didn't believe those were justified, that if you have the burden, there was no other alternative valuation that he could utilize. So why wouldn't that be not clear error if he rejected those? It can't be 0. 9 seems way too low, and I don't have another valuation, and you have the burden. And he did point out there were potential other valuations that could have been proposed, but were not.
Okay. Your Honor, there are two responses to that, and I'll be brief, recognizing the time. One, we don't believe we bear the burden of the initial burden of proof with respect to that issue. We think that if this court should follow the decision in Harry's Highgate from the Third Circuit.
Can I interrupt you for 1 second? You can go back to Judge Bianco's question. Was the issue of burden ever raised by the appellants before the reply brief?
Your Honor, I do. We obviously urge that the court, we think we met our burden below. I do think it was raised at least somewhat in the opening briefs, but it certainly came into focus in response to what the debtors
I don't. I don't think it was raised. I don't think it was raised in the opening. Let's just assume you have the burden.
Yes, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I was going to. Let's just assume that you have the burden. Why wouldn't bankruptcy court be permitted to say, I don't think 0 and 9 are correct, and there's no other alternative valuation?
Your Honor, we presented substantial evidence on this very issue in the joint appendix, page 4,200. Is the expert report of Ms. Murray, in that she goes through an analysis of what those letters of credit are and concludes that they're unlikely to be drawn because 90.6% of them are letters of credit that relate to workers' compensation. And in the event that there was a liquidation or in the event that there was a sale of it, and what actually happened here was those letters of credit were assumed by the purchaser.
Okay, but then let's say that's true, but then what would the valuation be? Like 10%?
Then you would, yes, you would exclude the 90% of them that are unlikely to be drawn. Her conclusion was that it was unlikely that any of them would be drawn. And that was the evidence that we presented. And in our view, that evidence was unrebutted. Even if we bore the burden of proof, that evidence was unrebutted. The bankruptcy court simply ignored that. And again, we have in our reply brief, we've got a chart that lays out each of the factual recitations, the factual elements that we presented on those two issues. Because I think, again, we don't think we bear the burden, but even if we do, we think it was more than met. And in fact, not only was it more than met, it was met without any evidence on the other side. And I don't think Judge Craig disagrees with that. He just concluded that we hadn't met our burden, notwithstanding the fact that we presented substantial evidence on each of those issues. Can I ask you? In particular, as the first one, the value of the non-borrowing-based inventory.
Okay.
Obviously, there's no controversy here. Both parties agreed it was worth substantial amounts of money.
And with Judge Sullivan's permission, I have one question about the NBB inventory. The bankruptcy court said there's no detail in the record as to what collateral is covered with respect to the debtor's overall book value valuation. What's your response to that?
We presented substantial evidence of that. And in fact, the debtor's own valuation that they presented was substantially higher than what the bankruptcy court included here.
I saw that, but I didn't see a discussion of what was being included in that, right?
The debtors valued the entirety of they used 85% as
right.
the valuation. They applied that to
everything.
All of the inventory, including the non-borrower-based inventory.
Okay.
And that was including the debtors. We also presented, the three experts on the appellate side presented substantial evidence of what inventory was considered in that. And we think at core, this was just a rushed job, a rushed conclusion that the court reached that didn't really consider the evidence that was presented through the trial.
But, I mean, what were you arguing to the bankruptcy court?
In terms of the non-borrowing base?
Yeah.
Yeah, Your Honor, we were arguing that it was worth what it cost on its books to acquire. So, in other words, the replacement cost of that. So the experts each looked to the books and records of the debtors.
Right. And are you still arguing that? Or are you now hedging and saying it just had to be more than what the bankruptcy court concluded?
Your Honor, we're still arguing that it was worth the replacement cost that draft requires. And on remand, we would establish that. What the bankruptcy court, both parties said it was worth, the debtor said it was worth between $250 and $300 million. We said it was worth at least that and potentially more. The court said it was worth zero. So we're arguing that the court was wrong.
So your position is because of Mr. Griffith's testimony, the minimum amount it should be $255 million.
Correct.
That's the lowest.
You're saying it's like a baseball arbitration where each side gives a number and the judge has to pick the one that's most defensible?
No, Your Honor. Right. I think the judge has to find a replacement value. We don't think he did that. But again, what I'm saying is that even the debtors used $85 million, which we believe was more akin to a liquidation value or what the rash decision would say would be a foreclosure value, which was not appropriate. But at a minimum, in a baseball arbitration, if one party's asking for $8 million and one's asking for 12, and the arbitrator says you get 2, then that would be a basis for an appeal of that decision. And that's essentially what happened here.
Well, in a baseball arbitration, presumably, I don't want to get too into baseball arbitrations, but nobody really has the burden of proof, right? You each pick a number and the judge then decides what the proof best supports. This is a situation where the burden of proof does seem to really matter.
Well,
kind of shocking to me that it's not been sort of fully developed at this point. I mean, generally, in most matters in courts, the burden of proof is pretty clear, but here it's not.
I think with respect to the borrowing base, the non-borrowing base inventory, that's a head scratcher for us because even if we bore the burden of proof, the debtor's own evidence valued that at least $255 million. So you couldn't say that we bore the burden of proof and didn't establish that it was worth at least that. We argued for higher than that. But at a minimum, the fact that we and the debtors both presented evidence to suggest that it was worth at least that has to mean that we had a burden to prove it to be at least that much. I think the court can misapply rash, he did the wrong analysis. But even if he did the right analysis, that's clear error.
Okay. All right.
Thank you, Ron.
Well, why don't we stop there? Thank you very much. You got your money's worth there, Mr. LeBlanc. We'll now hear from Mr. Silbert. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yes, you are. Thank you very much. Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Greg Silbert from Washington Beat Appellees. I'll start with the rash issue. Rash tells us that the valuation of collateral has to be based on the actual use or disposition of the collateral. In this case, at the beginning of the bankruptcy, on the petition date, there were two facts that everyone knew about the disposition of this collateral. Number one, everybody knew that very, very soon we would be selling all of it and not retaining any of it. And that's because selling everything, disposing of substantially all of our assets, was the only way, as Judge Ray explained, that we could generate a recovery to pay our friends here at the 2Ls and our other creditors. The second fact that everybody knew on the beginning of the petition meeting, on the next meeting, was that when we sold all of the 2L's collateral, every last piece of it, we would not be recovering the full book for retail value on those sales. If you see a store that has a big sign saying everything must go, you know that store is selling at a discount. And effectively, at the beginning of the bankruptcy, Sears had a giant neon sign over not just one store, but the entire business saying everything must go and it must go fast. And so we knew, the 2Ls knew, Judge Jordan knew, that it was in no way realistic to expect the full retail or book value recovery.
Can I ask you two questions? First of all, is it your position that the use or disposition language relates to what you just argued, which is how the inventory or the property was ultimately going to be used versus what the appellants argue, which is it's just about the binary of retain or surrender? That's certainly what they argue. And the language in the decision itself suggests as much, that that's what it means when they say use or disposition. It's keep or surrender.
Well, that's what it meant in Rash, because those were the two possibilities of Rash. But those were not realistic possibilities in this case. And in fact, you know, what Rash tells you, if you go outside of the Chapter 13 context and just look at the statutory language about valuation of collateral, which says proposed use or disposition, Rash says, what is the actual proposed use or disposition? And there was no question in anyone's mind in this case that the proposed disposition of these assets, the 2L's collateral, was to sell all of them so that none of them would remain in Sears' hands. And everyone knew that was going to happen very, very quickly.
But after they were retained by Sears.
Well, I don't even know. The disposition of collateral like this, which was billions of dollars in inventory, is a process that's going to take time. Right. So you have to look at the completion of that process and not, you know, the first day when it starts, which is essentially what the 2Ls are asking to do. So the 2Ls tell us that they could have sold the collateral, even quote, surrendered it to them. That was never a realistic option, but let's assume that it was, okay? Assume they're going to take possession of $2 billion worth of washing machines and tools and automotive parts. They're going to have to spend quite a bit of time already. They're going to have trucks to transport it, warehouses to put it in. They're going to have to hire thousands of employees to manage this process, to do accounting and tax treatment. So if there was a, quote, surrender, again, never really on the menu here, but if they say it was, then even then, if you look at sort of day two of the bankruptcy or day five of the bankruptcy, you could say, well, you know, Sears packs and stuff in its stores, sure. But that's not the proposed disposition or use of the collateral. The proposed disposition is, in our case, in the real world, was we were going to sell all of it and not have any of it in our hands, right? But under any scenario, day two of the bankruptcy, of course we're going to have some collateral. That's not retention in the sense that's relevant to Rash. In Rash, at the end of the bankruptcy, when the dust settled, it's all said and done, Mr. Rash had the keys to his truck in his pocket. Everybody knew that very, very soon after this bankruptcy started, and in point of fact, he was only 3 months into the bankruptcy that we agreed on the sale, and 4 months that the bankruptcy court judge approved the sale, everybody knew very quickly we would be getting rid of all of these assets and not keeping any of them in our hands. So the actual proposed disposition here as a judge sell it, right? And so he appropriately valued the collateral as Rash was stressed based on that actual disposition. What could we get by selling it? And nobody thought we would actually get full book or retail value from those sales because, as you said, Judge Chen, you know, we are a highly distressed seller. And that is the important point that RESCAP stands for applied in Rash. When a distressed seller is selling its merchandise, you can't do a valuation that assumes full book or retail value as if it were a healthy going concern making sales in the ordinary course of business. So, you know, Judge Gray applied Rash exactly as he should. I think this burden question is quite important, as I believe all of you have mentioned. It's not just that the two L's first argued in their reply brief in this court that they had the burden, that we had the burden. We're trying to shift the burden to us. What actually happened is the two L's repeatedly and expressly acknowledged in the bankruptcy court that they did have the burden. And I'd like to give you a few sites for that, because if you want to hear them, because we were not able to respond to this point since it was first raised in the reply brief. But if you look at JA4459, you will see testimony from ESL's counsel. He says, quote, "Now we have the burden of proving what our secure claim was." Then if you look at JA4843, this is not, I'm sorry, not testimony, but argument. This is argument from Cyrus's counsel. He is contrasting the 507B claim, the one that's before you now, with a separate surcharge claim under 506C, a claim that the debtors brought, we brought. And Cyrus's counsel says, quote, "The burden is very different. In a 507B calculation, we, that's the two L's, have the burden, versus their, that is the debtors, having to satisfy their surcharge burden." There is also a brief. This brief is independent for some reason. It's at JA3993. This is a joint brief by all the two L's. And the two L's say the second main parties understand that prevailing on this motion, which is a motion in limine, will not relieve their burden of demonstrating its actual dilution in the banks. So everybody understood.
Mr. Silva, assuming they do have that burden, I want you to turn to the letters of credit, because they would say, with respect to that, they established that the debtors didn't treat it as outstanding debt. They put on the testimony of three experts who said it should not be counted at all, including one based upon decades of experience. As they noted, Ms. Murray noted that 90% is not related to trade vendors. It's workers' comp, insurance, a surety bond, which... if the company's not going to continue, but obviously not be eaten up. So in light of that evidence, why haven't they met that burden of establishing that to treat it at its full amount was clear error?
So thank you, Mr. Banker. So first, there's no dispute that the letters of credit are seen for debt. The debtor in possession orders that so itself. So everyone knows...
It's contingent debt.
Senior contingent debt. That's
right.
Exactly right. And as to the 90% that the 2L's are challenging here, which relates to workers' comp obligations, the decision to draw on those letters of credit is up to the workers' compensation boards, which have fiduciary duties to the employees. Now, Sears had tens of thousands of employees, and obviously there were substantial workers' comp liabilities. Many of those liabilities would extend out over decades. So
what reasoning did the bankruptcy court give for deducting the full amount, rejecting the experts? I mean, obviously he doesn't have to accept the experts, but what reasons did he give for saying they're wrong? The only thing I could find was at Special Appendix 28. It appears clear to me that the letters of credit would be drawn either immediately or upon their expiration date. The beneficiaries of the letters of credit would not simply let their collateral in the form of a letter of credit go away. But that's it.
And there was some more discussion along those lines in the argument, but
that's a conclusion. But what is that based on?
It's exactly the two-step process that you outlined, Justice Ginsburg. So the first question is, would they be drawn at all? And then the second question is, if so, in what amount? And as to the first question, it's clear that they would be drawn, which is what my earlier comments were going to, because in a liquidation scenario, in that order of liquidation value, where Sears is no longer available to pay those workers' comp liabilities, the workers' comp boards have a creditworthy source that is on the hook for the obligations under the letters of credit. It's a very straightforward question as to whether they would be drawn at all. Are those workers' comp boards going to give up hundreds of millions of dollars of credit, or are they going to choose to access it? They're going to take it. They're not going to give away the free money. That's what Judge Gray did. The next part of the analysis is exactly the part that you discussed, Judge Bianco, which is, okay, we know that the letters of credit would be drawn to some extent. So, to how much? And if the 2Ls wanted to say that the letters would not be drawn to their full face amount, they could have put on evidence to me.
What's wrong with 9 million? Why not 9 million?
Not 9 million is what happened at the end of the bankruptcy because ESL.
I understand that, but that is an alternative number that was out there that, again, wasn't really discussed as to why that would be insufficient. You put on, there was no testimony that I think could be relied upon to suggest anything else, right?
Mr. Griffith
is not a liquidation expert. He said it was based upon, he's a lay witness, discussion with colleagues. I mean, that is hardly a basis to rely on, I would suggest.
So, Your Honor, again, the question is, given that the 2Ls bear the burden, did they satisfy it? We don't think they satisfied it with the $9 million, because the $9 million is what happened when ESL actually bought all the collateral and the rest of Sears' business. And when that happened, ESL assumed the obligation. So there was no reason for the letters of credit to be drawn then, just as there was no reason for them to be drawn on the petition date. Because after the petition date, Sears was paying the workers' comp obligations. The question is, in a net orderly liquidation where there's no more Sears, Sears is not paying these liabilities anymore, and these workers' comp boards have access, they have recourse to the letter of credit issues, are they going to draw the letters of credit? Number one, of course. And then number two, if so, in what amount? Well, the 2L's only answer was nothing, or maybe $9 million, because when ESL assumed the obligations, that's the amount that was drawn. But Judge Drain properly rejected both of those accounts as not based on any kind of convincing evidence. And the 2Ls did not put in anything else. So Judge Drain had before him exactly the choice that you described. That, you
know, all right. On the MBV inventory, it's kind of the same posture, I would suggest, but they had their experts as to how it should be valued. As was noted, Mr. Griffith suggested 85% of book value for the whole inventory, which obviously would include that, which would be $255 million. So what would be, obviously the court doesn't have to accept, as Judge Sullivan pointed out, any of those numbers, but what was the reasoning for rejecting even Mr. Griffith's valuation? What reasoning did the bankruptcy court give?
Well, the bankruptcy court did not accept Mr. Griffith's valuation of any of the collateral. He began with Ms. Murray's valuation.
Okay.
Ms. Murray, like Tiger, on which she relied, did not assign any value at all to any of the ineligible inventory except for in-transit inventory. So let's be clear. That Ms. Murray, when she was valuing the ineligible inventory for her valuation, she submitted her report to Judge Drain and Lydon. She did not assign any value whatsoever to any of the ineligible inventory except in-transit inventory, okay? And she valued that in-transit inventory at about $75 million, just shy of $75 million. So the very most that Judge Drain had to value the ineligible inventory to meet clear error review would be that. Well, one of the 2L's own experts valued that. Can't be any higher than that. And that's an important range. It's somewhere between zero and
I don't understand why, if you in fact put testimony on and there's some issue with one of their experts' method of valuation, why can't they also say, well, if you don't like our expert, we suggest you go by what Mr. Griffith said. Why are they not allowed to do that?
Well, it's not that they're allowed to, Judge, it's that this is clearer review. And so you have to look at whether the finding that the judge made had a basis in the record. Survive that very deferential standard of review. And certainly,
the argument would be that when your witness says $255 million is the valuation, that a failure to explain the reasoning for rejecting that is clear error.
So the entire valuation began not with our witness, but with Ms. Murray, right? The judge accepted Ms. Murray's top line valuation. And Ms. Murray did not assign $255 million. She assigned $75 million.
To part of it.
Sorry?
To part of it. To the in-transit. To
the rest of it, she assigned no. The sum of all value to ineligible inventory in Ms. Murray's report was $75 million. The in-transit got $75 million, the rest of it got zero.
Right, but I think the point is that there's a number of different opinions and there's evidence offered. And it's not the judge has to pick one report or one expert that he agrees with, right? I mean, there's a range. There's a lot of evidence. He has to consider it all and has to then come up with a number. And he has to then defend that number or at least have make sure that it's a rational number. So what's the basis for saying that the number the judge came up with here was rational based on the evidence that's in the record? None of it was reliable?
So, no, there's another piece of evidence which is significant, which is that asset-based lenders were deciding how much money they would lend to Sears based on inventory. They would not lend us any money at all based on ineligible inventory by definition. So we could not borrow one single penny based on our ownership of those assets. And what that means is those asset-based lenders were not satisfied that Sears would be able to convert those assets into cash, because if they knew for sure that we could turn the assets into cash, they wouldn't let this fund. But the lender said, sorry, we're not going to lend you a penny based on that ineligible report. And then Ms. Murray, who's a one of the two LSBs, said, well, I'm not going to assign no value to any of the
They also cited the statement of the chief restructuring, Better's chief restructuring officer, that suggested a 90% valuation. They said the debtor's October 2018 borrowing base certificate lists the NBB inventory at $300 million.
That's book value. But the whole point of NBB is the debtor's term stands for non-borrowing.
Right.
What it means is the asset-based lenders were not willing to lend us any money at all against those assets. And the reason that they're not willing to lend money against those assets is they are not convinced that Sears would be able to turn those assets into cash to pay the debt. That's the whole point of it. So obviously it has some significant discount. Judge Sullivan, you asked the 2L today, was your position below some value over zero, or was it full book or retail value? And I believe my friend on the other side answered full book or retail value. And again, they have the burden, and it certainly is subject to some very significant discount. It has to, the range when we're doing fair review has to be between zero, which is what Judge Rain found, and what the asset-based lenders were willing to ascribe to it, and 75, which is what the 2L's expert gave it. It can't be any more than 75. And that's significant, because even if you added $75 million to the valuation of the collateral on the petition deed, the 2L still got more value from their collateral than they were entitled to when you factor in the credit bid. You remember that the credit bid was over $433 million. That was all based on the valuation of the collateral. What Judge Strain found was the 2L's residual interest in the collateral on the petition date was something like $170 million, mm-hmm. right? So when you subtract the credit bid, they got more value than they were entitled to already, not less. And that would still be true even if you added the entire $75 million valuation in ineligible inventory that Ms. Murray proposed. So we think the clearer range before you is between 0 and 75. And even if you went at the very high end of that range, it would not change the outcome of this case at all.
All right. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Silbert.
Thank you.
Mr. LeBlanc, you've got 3 minutes or so.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I want to focus my reply, at least at the beginning, on the rash question. The court, when faced with the question of how to value the collateral, had to choose what the debtors, had to identify what the debtors have done, and then choose how to value the collateral based upon that. We have not identified, they've not cited, we've not found a single case that hasn't, after rash, used a replacement value method when the debtor chooses to retain the collateral. That is true in every context. There's no case that says rash is limited to a Chapter 13 case or it's limited to a cram-down scenario. There are legions of cases that say it applies with equal force to a Chapter 11 case, which this was, and it applies with equal force to the determination of an adequate protection claim.
Well, I mean, I guess footnote 6 of Rash suggests that replacement value is, more expansive or broad than you're giving it credit for?
It gets back to what we talked about. And I think the nuts and bolts case is a good example of this, where the court says, and in fact, you can even look at what Congress did in 2005 in adopting 506A2. where the court said in some circumstances you might need to use retail value, in some circumstances you might use wholesale value. That's the point of it. And if there was a circumstance where the goods themselves were damaged, you have to value them as damaged goods. So in the case of Mr. Rasher's truck, it had to be valued with all its dents and bumps and all of its problems.
So your position is even if there was consent and even if the assets were immediately going to be sold, you still would use replacement value. Is that your position?
That is our position, Your Honor. We think that the debtor's decision to retain the collateral in return for providing us with adequate protection, there's no case that says in that circumstance that the debtor retains the collateral.
Retains for the purpose, but it could be retains for the purpose of immediately selling.
Well,
right?
Mark, to be clear, that's point two that I wanted to make. The actual use by the debtors of our collateral in this case was not an immediate liquidation of those assets. The actual use of our collateral was a going concern operation by the debtors. That's what they actually did. They continued to operate their stores. They used that property to generate a stream of income. Exactly.
I thought the bankruptcy court did value part of it as a going concern. Or am I misunderstanding?
No, Your Honor. He chose a number. He did what the Seventh Circuit had done in Hopkins that the Rash court overturned. He picked a number between a full foreclosure value and a value that was based on replacement value. What he different term is liquidation value. But Your Honor, the simple reality was when the debtor made the election to retain the collateral, they chose to continue to operate as a going concern retailer. And they sold our collateral. They didn't sell it at replacement value. They sold it at a higher retail price. So they earned money by doing it. That was their election. That election comes with the consequence that they have to compensate us with replacement value. That is the trade that a debtor has to make. That's what Rash says the court needs to do. Is if the debtor chooses to retain the collateral for the purpose of generating an income, that has a consequence, and that is that it needs to then compensate the creditor who doesn't have the use, as they would under state law, doesn't have the use of their collateral. It needs to compensate them with replacement value. That is exactly how the court should interpret Rasher. Frankly, it's the way that every other court has done it. Heritage Highgate, again, not with respect to burden issue, but with respect to this same issue, Heritage Highgate talks to using Rash in the Chapter 11 for adequate protection purposes. It's exactly the same issue. Your Honor, I know my time has expired. I'm happy to address any issues on the other two points, the non-borrower's collateral. I just very, very briefly on that. The fact that it wasn't part of the borrowing base for the first lien lenders to lend against in no way, shape, or form suggests that it doesn't have value. There's no question about that. They value it at substantial dollars. It is irrelevant to that, to the analysis. The fact that the lenders wouldn't lend against it meant that the lenders had more collateral to support the loans.
What about that Ms. Murray only valued it at $76 million, whatever it was?
Ms. Murray only valued a portion of the collateral. In her own analysis, she said this is the floor for the adequate protection claim. She only valued a portion of the collateral. There's a portion of it she simply didn't value. She didn't ascribe no value to it. The other two experts and their own witnesses ascribed value to that category of non-borrowing-based inventory that was not in transit inventory. Ms. Murray just didn't find something that she could point to put a number against it. So she didn't ascribe a zero value. She just didn't do the exercise. The other experts and their own witnesses did.
So what are you asking us to do then? Send it back to Judge Drain to do what?
We think you have to send it back to Judge Drain. You should reverse and remand to Judge Drain for a determination of the adequate protection claim here, of the secured lender's claim.
So you're not saying we should go with what you were pitching to Judge Drain. You're saying that Judge Drain should come up with a different number, but it shouldn't be any lower than what the debtor's expert said.
No, Your Honor. Well, that is true, but I don't think that's the end of the analysis. What we think Your Honor should do is we think you should conclude that the judge had to apply replacement value to determine the value of the collateral. They concede he didn't do that. That's not what he did.
But maybe I missed this. Did anyone provide that information to Judge Drain?
Absolutely.
You're saying your experts calculated replacement value using their methodology. All right, go ahead.
They did. And Your Honor, Judge Drain used a different analysis. So he didn't ascribe a number to, if I use replacement value, this is the outcome. So we do think it's a remand to Judge Drain. We think there's evidence in the record that could support Your Honor's reaching the conclusion because The collateral, just the inventory portion of our collateral, was purchased by the debtors for more than the full amount of the
But even if we disagree with you on that point,
sorry,
even if we disagree with you on the replacement value issue, you would be asking us to send it back because you think the other errors would add up potentially to $246 million and therefore provide a claim. Is that?
The other two issues saying, well, even if you use the low end of their value range with the letters of credit, $655 million. And so those issues standing alone.
Depending on how those get resolved, you could hit 246, even if you don't get replacement value.
Correct, Your Honor. And obviously, if we do, then the numbers, we're obviously limited by the amount of our claim, which is approximately $780 million that we were left unpaid. But those two issues standing alone are enough to make it not harmless error, if you agree with us that it was in fact error. So we would urge that the court remand the matter to Judge Green for consideration in light of what we think is a clear mistake in the application of Rash and is clear error with respect to the other two issues that we've raised on appeal.
Meaning the MBB and the credit letters of credit.
Yes, Your Honor. I know Mr. Aker hasn't spoken, but obviously he's resting on papers with respect to the ESL issue as well, which the court would have to decide as well.
So my general worry about this remand proposal is that what you're saying is this would encourage or incentivize people to go for broke in front of the bankruptcy court, and then if you lose, you run to the Court of Appeals and say that we should get another bite at the apple because it should be something higher than what the two sort of extreme offers were. I mean, it's in the baseball analogy, it's sort of saying, if you lose on yours, you get to ask the judge to go back and find a midpoint.
Your Honor, I don't think that's what we're asking at all. We presented replacement value.
Right.
As
okay, but so if we send this back and don't agree with you on Rash, then what are you arguing in front of Judge Drain?
Well, if you reverse him with respect to the determination as to the letters of credit and the non-borrowing base, but you don't reverse him with respect to his value of the collateral, the Rash issue, then we're arguing that that we presented sufficient evidence that he, we're arguing as we did, and to answer a question Your Honor asked earlier, we did argue the burden of proof in our reply papers in the district court below. It's in our reply brief in the district court below. I have the document entry. I can get the court in a second, but Your Honor, he misconstrued. He committed clear error. And it's not as though we don't want to present additional evidence that we think we presented more than sufficient evidence. He should decide.
So you're not going to, it's not going to open up the record.
We don't think it has to, Your Honor. We think he has to decide it on the record.
He could also provide additional reasoning potentially to justify the numbers that he gave it. Isn't that another possibility?
That's what you're proposing, right?
Well, and that is what we're proposing. We're proposing a remand where Judge Drain decides the issue. We don't need the record reopened. We think the record is clear. And Judge Bianchi, you're right. He could reach the same decision.
So even though Mr. Griffith said $255 million, whatever it is, he could explain. I didn't think Mr. Griffith was right either. Right?
He could certainly do that, Your Honor. That what's clear is, and I think Your Honor's faced this all the time, is where a trier of fact makes a clear error, asking for the remand is not asking for a second bite of the apple. It's asking for the court below to do what it should have done, which is to properly weigh the evidence. And in this instance, it's clear to us that he didn't properly weigh the evidence with respect to those issues and the supply crash.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor. Well, appreciate the accommodation as well.
No, thank you all. It's a pleasure to have you here. Well argued, well briefed. We will reserve decision, of course. We'll now move